Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As promised, we do have Chef Kevin Gillespie, Top Chef alum from season 6, also Top Chef Duel alum, and we were really upset to see you leave. and I think this was one of those, I lost my number one pick, Kevin, Chef. I picked in our fantasy draft that we do, I picked Gregory in my number one overall pick, and Kevin picked you. So we have both lost our number one picks.
You know what? It's this season was hard. I mean, I'm telling, like, it's the most obvious thing I could possibly say, but it genuinely was really, really hard. Like, every single challenge was difficult. The parameters, they figured out, frankly, like, the folks who produced the show have figured out how to, like, tweak it just enough to make it just a little bit extra difficult. And it's nothing you guys can see. It's like, we have, you know, $20 too few in our budget. It's little things like that that they sort of added to the All-Star version that it made it a lot more challenging.
That's so funny because they've never really tested that you don't have enough money, which, like, to me is a great tension moment.
Right.
Who had the most trouble on the show being budget savvy?
I think probably Brian Malarkey, because he wants to, like, buy everything. You know, he wants to have 30 versions of whatever it was that he was going to do. I never had very much trouble with it because I've always been very good at sort of ad-libbing, I guess you'd say. So when something doesn't work, I just make something else. Stephanie Smart has never had much of an issue with it because she kind of always knew what she wanted to make. But some people would definitely test the boundaries. Gregory, he was hilarious because he would come up to the register knowingly over budget and would, like, one thing and be like, okay, and then add another thing and be like, okay. And then, like, he would sort of sort what he was making at the register.
That's funny.
So, because you can't, as weird as it sounds, like, they won't let you run around with a calculator, like, doing the math while you're in the store. So you have
that's
to wait.
Interesting.
You have to wait until they ring it up. And then, so the first time you know whether you're over budget is as they're ringing it. And the rule says, once it's been rung up, like, once you've paid, there is no, so basically you can have them scan it, but once it's been run through, like, you have it. So that's it.
And also pork is cheaper than like scallops and fish and stuff.
Yeah. And you know, I'm just like, everybody thinks I'm just like, they're like, why don't you ever want to cook with anything else? And I keep telling them, because we're at a grocery store, like no knock on Whole Foods, but I cook a ton of seafood in my actual professional life, but I buy from very, very specific fishermen. Like, I don't know where that stuff's coming from. And I just get weirded out by grocery store seafood. So I usually never end up using it because it creeps me out.
Kevin, you have I'll say chef, because I don't, Kevin, you have a background of the Top Chef studio, but chef, your background is one of your businesses in Atlanta, Old Reliable. And we wanted to ask, how are your businesses doing in response to the COVID-19 epidemic?
It's been challenging, to say the least. So, you know, we made a decision really early on that we were going to shut everything down and we were going to shift gears entirely. And I think that that was really challenging. It was certainly the hardest day of my career to tell my staff, like, I'm sorry, guys, we're going to all have to become unemployed, including myself, long enough for us to circle the wagons. But thankfully, we did that pretty quickly. And so we moved forward doing mostly charity work. And I've been very, very fortunate in this respect that we had an idea and it felt like it was the right time. And so we immediately started making phone calls and advocating on people's behalf. And so we got the team back to work and have been making food for a charity that we run called Meals of Love, while also doing World Central Kitchen on Jose Andreas's charity. And then another Atlanta charity called Compassion Kitchen. So we've been really, really hyper busy. That being said, only as of this past weekend have we started reopening to the public. So Revival reopened on Friday. Cold Beer reopens next weekend. Gun Show reopens almost exactly 1 month to the day from today. But Old Reliable, oddly enough, is probably the one that will reopen maybe the latest, because it is literally located in like the hub, like central business district in Atlanta, and folks are not back in the office yet. So I don't know that they'll be back anytime soon. It might open next year, to be very honest with you.
I say this not to flatter you. Being a native Atlanta, and I come home like four times a year, the restaurant selections are very important. Where am I going to eat? Gun Show is honestly, I mean, that and Staple House are my two favorite Atlanta restaurants. It was funny, because the first time I visited your restaurant, I think it was like maybe 15 or 16, 17. It was pretty soon after it opened. I had to do something I've never had to do in Atlanta, which is I had to call in a favor. Like, I couldn't get in. I could not get in. And so I called, a friend who's kind of a big shot. And I said, you got to get me a table for three. Like, I want to take two friends and I'm not going to take no for an answer and I'm not going to wait. So, because I don't wait anywhere. And mission accomplished. Awesome. And I love, and also I'm a big dim sum guy. I think there's been this great debate about small plates and there's this small plate backlash. But I like to look at a menu, mark down what I want, and I want as many tastes on the plate as possible. I think it's fun to do it that way, just even the interactive nature of a pencil. But I'm a fan of the format. I'm obviously a fan of your food. And it's just like Gun Show's a fun place to eat.
Well, that's it. Is it like when I built Gun Show, the whole purpose of Gun Show was to try to, you know, to use a sports analogy, because I feel like that's the only way I talk to my friends, is that like somebody has to constantly try to move the ball down the field. Like, we can't always run the safe play. And so Gun Show is the Hail Mary of like restaurants, and that we said, let's try something. I know that it might not work, and that's fine. If it doesn't work, whatever, like we'll close and do something else. But the thing is, it has worked because it's so experiential, and it's not just about the food. It's about the totality of the experience. You, the guest, are as important to the role in the restaurant. Like, you play an active role in the way it works. And I don't think that's true of most restaurants. Most restaurants, you go in, you're passive. You order what you want, the food comes to you. At Gun Show, that interaction between you and the staff is that's what it is. That's the entire place. And so we've been very fortunate that it is nearly impossible to get into. It is impossible to get into it right now because it's closed. But we're getting ready, and I'm fingers and toes crossed, reservations for reopening will begin at the end of this week. And we're just hopeful that sort of that energy that we've had for the last nearly 8 years keeps going.
So speaking of restaurants, Kevin and I have talked about the Restaurant Wars format for this season versus years past. This background here is when Kevin and I got to go to Restaurant Wars 2 years ago in Lexington, Kentucky. And there's Kevin and there's me there and our partners. So we got to see firsthand what it is like to get in a backed up restaurant. Yeah. We waited for an hour in line. They poured rosé down our throats to make it feel better. It was hot. It was sticky. And we got a first person account of what it's like to be in this pop-up restaurant wars. And you won the pre episode of Restaurant Wars for Country Captain. And I know that you've been outspoken about Restaurant Wars in past seasons. Yeah. So can you walk us through when you found out about this year's Restaurant Wars and kind of the bittersweet element of winning the Country Captain concept and going into the next episode?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, I didn't intend to win. I was actually, it's funny, like I play to win 100 times out of 100. But the reality is that I was trying to land squarely in the middle in that pre-challenge. I did not want my restaurant chosen because I am a very, very outspoken critic of the format of Restaurant Wars. You know, I've never backed down on the fact that I don't like it. I don't think it's realistic. And more importantly, I guess maybe because I am a restaurant chef. Not every person who competes on Top Chef is an owner operator, but I am. And so I think I take a little bit of, it's a bit offensive to me the way that they conduct Restaurant Wars, because I think it takes away from the reality of like how hard it actually is and how much work, and the fact that it's never responsible to open prematurely. It's never okay to do any number of the things that are okay in Restaurant Wars. You know, I would never open with an untrained staff. I would never do any of these things. And so I think I get a little too in my head for it, which inevitably always costs me because I'm unwilling to back off of my principles and just play the game, frankly, like compete with the rules that are set in front of you. But I'm just a complete hard-headed jerk and won't do that. So yeah, with Country Captain, it was interesting when they called the names of the people whose concepts they liked the most. I was happy in a sense because I felt very vindicated in the fact that I had done a good job. And honest to God, like that prelim episode where I made all the food myself, it was some of the best food I've made all season. I knew it was perfect, to be honest with you. And I was kind of torn between the fact that I wanted to do really great work, but I didn't want them to think my concept was interesting enough to make into a grand concept. So I kind of purposely left a bunch of holes in it, thinking, oh, they'll pick that apart. They won't be able to critique the food. The food will be great, but they won't find enough in the concept to be willing to move it forward. And I guess I was completely wrong about that. So, which also ended up costing me because frankly, I did pitch a not fully baked concept, which ended up being really challenging to try to piece it all together in such quick order for the actual real Restaurant Wars challenge. And I think that was part of one of the things that caused us problem is that it wasn't Gregory's concept is an idea he has been working on for 2 years now. So it was really good. Mine was something I worked on for about 35 seconds. So,
by the way, do we think anybody else sandbagged it?
You know, I don't know. It's, I asked a lot of them, to be honest with you. I asked them to sort of work way outside of their comfort zone.
I meant, do you think any other chef was sort of like, I'm going to put forward a pretty mediocre idea, you know, cook good food, and I'm going to finish squarely. I'm going to become a sous chef where you're absolutely guaranteed pretty much to move on unless you completely shit the bed. And
Stephanie got immunity, and she delivered, I think, the neighborhood pub idea, essentially.
Yeah.
She did, but I'll say, like, I don't mean this as an insult to Stephanie, but Stephanie, her having immunity in that challenge was really important for her because she has literally never, ever even considered opening a restaurant. And so I think that she was terrified at what she was being asked to do and incredibly happy to not have to do it. So, and I think she would tell you that too, that she does not aspire to have a restaurant. I think that Melissa and Brian Voltaggio, I think they tried very hard with their concepts to put it forward. I think that the only reason they didn't pick Melissa's is that it would have been, I actually think it would have been so difficult to execute at Restaurant Wars that they thought, okay, we can't do this because we're going to make both teams serve 100 and something people. And Melissa's concept is to serve 25. Like, so it's just not, it doesn't work. Voltaggio's concept, they don't really give much feedback on the show about it. But basically what they thought was that the concept and the food were not cohesive. So long story short, no, I don't think anybody tried to sandbag it. I think that I have done this so many times. I've opened so many restaurants, not just my own, but have been hired to develop other people's, that I know how to pitch a restaurant. The same with Brian Mullarkey. I think the reason he was so successful is because he has done this literally countless times. And so we sort of made our own bed to a certain degree.
Do you guys, you get to taste each other's dishes. If so, what's the best thing you tasted this season?
Well, sometimes, you know, when we get to taste them in quick fires a lot, not very much in elimination challenges. Like generally speaking, in the elimination, you never end up tasting any of anybody else's food, so you don't have any idea. But we do get to taste the quick fires quite a bit. You know, it's hard for me to like narrow down what was the single best bite of food that I tasted this year. And that's just my own fault because I get so jumbled. I will say that one of the few times that I ever got to taste anybody's food was in this very last elimination challenge. And I got to taste Stephanie's pasta because she made, like, I can't believe how much she made. Like, I can't believe she was capable of making that much. She made enough to feed 45 people. And so when she came back into the kitchen, she still had a lot of it, and I ate it, and I knew instantly that it was excellent. Like, and I was like, oh, that's going to be hard to beat, because it was that good.
Can we talk a little bit about Stephanie's arc here? Because sure. we're heading into the finale, and is she that self-deprecating behind the camera?
Yes, like 1,000 times more. I think it's hilarious. She and I clearly get each other's sense of humor. Sometimes my jokes are like they land dead on people, and the same with hers. Sometimes people don't get that she's really funny. I think she's hilarious.
She's incredible. She's definitely comedic relief on the show.
Yeah. But the thing is, a bunch of people send me messages and they don't understand that she's joking. They think that like we hate each other, and I'm like, no, we don't hate each other at all. We're friends. Like we text each other, we joke. Like we just have a sort of a funny sense of humor. So yes, she's more self-deprecating off camera than she is on camera. And it just plays into her personality. And frankly, like everything about her sort of ride through this season kind of matches that, because Stephanie is her own worst enemy. And I've said it to her face and have said it a million times. Like she has much more talent than she gives herself credit for. And so sometimes she doesn't have enough hubris, frankly, to succeed in every Top Chef challenge, because she gets in her own way. Like she gets in her own head. And I think honestly, the Restaurant Wars pitch episode is a perfect example of that. I think she was so convinced that there's no way she could pitch a restaurant because she's never done it that she kind of messed up. But like the talent's there. It's just, she just sometimes like she like beats herself up, which usually it's really funny. But then sometimes as her friend, you have to be like, hey, you know, take it easy on yourself. You're here for a reason.
I have to ask you about the pork copa. It was perfect in the kitchen. And then like, so what happens? Cause I'm a home chef. Like, yeah, I can do a few things, but yeah. Is it just, do things rest too long on the show?
I'll tell you what happened. It's unfortunately what happened is that this is a television show and they're full of shit sometimes. No, you know what, I'm surprised it didn't show up more in the actual episode, but this is normally I like to think I conduct myself pretty professionally at judges' table, and I'll talk to you about it, but I'm very professional. And I was not super professional in the judges' table because they were just wrong. I mean, I don't know any other way to say it. It was perfect. It was one of the most perfectly cooked and cut pieces of pork that you could ever imagine. And I was kind of a jerk about it. And I asked them at the judges' table, I was like, man, I wish there was somebody here who was like an expert in pork. You know, maybe somebody who's written an entire cookbook on pork, someone who is considered like an authority on pork that can talk about this. Oh, wait, that's me. So, that was one of the few times that I have just like absolutely steadfastly disagreed and said, look, if you don't get it, I'm sorry, but there was absolutely nothing wrong with that dish. I would fully embrace the critique of my pasta dish. I am not, and I'd be the first to admit, like, I'm bad at making pasta. I am not a pasta guy. We don't serve them in any of my restaurants because in my mind, it's a very specific nuance. Like, you do that. That is your, like, you love pasta and you get better and better every year. And I don't love it. I physically cannot eat it. It makes me ill. So I don't really make it. But the pork one, nah, that was just a classic case of TV bullshit.
So wait, what do they say when you push back? Like, they're a proud group. Like, what happened?
Oh, yeah, they try to, like, they sort of, like, sidestep it. And they're like, well, it probably, you know, maybe if it had a sauce. And I was like, no, the dish didn't need a sauce. It's not a dish that requires a sauce. And, in fact, if you thought it needed a sauce, it already had one. It was called apple sauce. So no.
Man, I wish we saw that version of it.
Yeah, like, Tom and I, like, butt heads periodically, but in a very professional way. Like, that's the thing about cooking, and honestly, cooking at a really high level, and especially if you're someone who has a particular sort of, call it a style, if you will, you have very strong opinions about it. And in that scenario, I fully disagree that you put any sort of jus or sauce with a pork copa. It has so much intramuscular fat that the goal is to serve it alongside almost exclusively things that have acidity and or that have some that have some density of texture, because it needs that. Like, it's not a sauced cut. It's not a lean piece of pork. And so saucing it is very a gilding the lily kind of scenario. And frankly, it's very much the antithesis of Italian cuisine. And so in that particular scenario, we just disagreed. And it's one of those things that, unfortunately, me thinking that doesn't change the fact that he has really the tie-breaking vote. And so in that scenario, I would go down the same way that I did in season 6, arguing about the texture of a particular cut of beef that he thought was too tough, that I thought was, when I've had it in his restaurants, I've said to him then, like, I think yours is too tender. I think it's mushy. So so it's just, you know, we just disagree, yeah, man. Like, that's just the way it is. It's just a, you know, professional disagreement, I guess you'd say.
When you found out that you were going to Tuscany, Chef, did you know that they were going to hit that basement?
No, not at all, man. Like, I had no idea. And for the record, by the way, that place is in Emilia Romagna, so it's technically in another region. We drove like 6 hours to get to it. It was awesome, and I'm really glad that we went. When I knew we were going to Tuscany, I felt actually pretty solid about it, because although I do not cook Tuscan food, Tuscans cook, as far as inside the Italian repertoire, Tuscan food is more similar to, I guess, the food that I cook. It tends to be very meat-centric. I cook a lot of beans and legumes. They make pasta, but that's not their primary source of starch. And so I actually felt pretty good about it. Turns out the majority of the challenges kind of worked outside of that realm. They sort of went into either to the fringes of Tuscan food or into the food of Emilia Romagna or other parts of Italy. And I think that's honestly because, and they told me this after the show was over, that they'd already planned to go to Italy, but we were supposed to go to Rome, and we couldn't find a hotel big enough for all of us to stay in. So we ended up in Tuscany instead.
I always make the assumption that when you get on that plane, chefs who are looking at a possible finale have their 4-course meal,
sure,
in their head. And by the way, a number of other dishes that you know, probably come up. Did you have your 4-courser?
No, not at all. They ask you for it in advance. And I just said, look, I don't really know. Like, I wrote down, I think I have a copy of it somewhere, and it says like, meat, second meat course, probably a steak. Like, and so it was like, right, very, very vague. But no, you are 100% right that I would tell you that I am the exception to the rule, that the vast, vast majority of people show up with a plan. Like, that's the dish they're making, followed by this next dish that they're making. And it's just, I can't cook that way, man. I'm really bad at that. And that's honestly, generally speaking, in Top Chef, when I stumble, it's in the challenges that require you to spend several days working on an idea. I've never been good at that as a cook. I'm a very spontaneous person. You know, you talked about Gun Show. Gun Show is built towards my strengths, which is constant change and evolution and being kind of fearless with the way that you cook. And it doesn't suit some of the challenges in Top Chef sometimes.
So let's rewind even further to your performance at Last Chance Kitchen.
Okay.
We fell in love with Last Chance Kitchen this season. And in some ways I find it more enjoyable to watch than the actual show.
I do.
What was like that experience for you? Because you probably had the most epic stretch there of Top Chef Last Chance Kitchen we've ever seen.
Well, so I didn't even know what Last Chance Kitchen was. It didn't exist on my in season 6. They hadn't come up with the idea yet. And so when I found myself in it, I didn't know what to expect. And I was unbelievably thankful that it works the way that it works, to be honest with you. For one, it is more fun. Like you said, it's more fun to watch. It's frankly more fun to do it. Tom's in a much better mood. He's very convivial. Like the whole atmosphere is a little bit different, and I like it better, to be honest with you. And then I thrive inside the sort of, if you want to call it, quick fire sort of setup. Like I just have always done that. Again, it plays to my strengths as a very spontaneous guy. I don't need to know what I'm going to make to start cooking. As weird as that sounds, I just start going and things tend to shape themselves out. And so I was extremely happy the second I realized how Last Chance Kitchen works. I went, oh, okay, I think I have a shot at this. And I didn't know when I got kicked off that that was going to be the case. I had no idea. It wasn't until, you know, a couple minutes into the very first cook against Nini that I went, oh, I think I might be able to pull this out, like, because it is playing right into my wheelhouse and not necessarily everybody else's wheelhouse.
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher turned podcast producer, and I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum-sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass-on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, noodle. Hey, boy. How you doing? And Noodle's just like,
ah, whatever. Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
You got to wait. So you were supposed to go to MIT or you applied to MIT? Like, yeah,
I was accepted to MIT for nuclear engineering, oddly enough. And actually went and spent the summer semester there and then made the decision that it just was not the right atmosphere for me. I didn't enjoy it. I felt very kind of out of place. And then really wanted to cook anyhow, had been cooking professionally as my job in high school and just decided, you know, I think I'm going to hit pause on this whole college thing for a minute, maybe save up a little money, do a little bit more cooking, like think this through. And then I just, honestly, I fell like headfirst into it. Then I never went back.
Yeah, Kevin, how many kids from Atlanta grow up in a kitchen and decide to go to MIT or have want to apply to it?
Yeah, I don't think very many. And the dean of MIT has been to Gun Show And they told me that I'm still the only person out of my high school to ever have been accepted. Hi.
She wanted to, she's going to take a nap, so she wanted to say, all right, have a good nap. Thank you, girl. Okay. Sorry about that.
No, you're good. Yeah, so I guess I'm still the only guy from my high school to ever be accepted to MIT.
Wait, where did you go to high school again? Not to get too far.
Henry County, so in the suburbs of Atlanta. Okay. Henry County High School. So, it was cool. Like, this was shortly after Gun Show opened. They came down for a visit. And I'm sure it was for the same stuff that happened when I was in high school, where basically if you want to get into MIT, it's a lot more challenging than just like writing an essay or applying. Like, there's a lot of in-site visits, you know, in-person visits. So they came into town and they brought me some MIT alumni gear and, you know, made me sort of an official, unofficial alumni of the school, which was pretty cool. So, yeah, it's awesome.
One of my favorite details reading your bios is that you you apparently were a voice of Aqua Teen Hunger Force. That was like my favorite stoner cartoon in college. And so finding that out, I have to ask, how does the Venn diagram of MIT accepted chef and Aqua Teen Hunger Force?
It's funny, man. TV voiceover work has become like my other career, which is so strange to say, and because I don't know how, other than I literally have friends who make cartoons for a living. And one day, one of them was like, can you do me a solid, Dave Willis, who created Aqua Teen Hunger Force? And he's like, can you come in the studio and do a voice for an alien for the show? I think you'd be perfect. And I'm like, I don't know how to take that, by the way, that you think my voice would be perfect for one of your aliens. But I came and I did a voiceover for Aqua Teen. And then next thing I know, I was invited back to do it a couple more times. And then I did Squidbillies, and I've done Archer, and I've done Your Pretty Face is Going to Hell. Like, it's just a weird thing that I've ended up doing now many times over. And it's always fun. Like, I love doing it. It's a cool way to sort of disconnect from your real life and just truly pretend to be something else. Hopefully I get more of it, man. I'm down. If you have an adult cartoon you need voiced over, like, just give this guy a call. I'll bring lunch. So,
I want to take advantage of your candor. So there's always sort of a battery of questions I love asking chefs and restaurateurs. One is your least favorite restaurant trend at the moment, aside from everything being closed. That's a terrible trend.
Yeah, I was like, I'm not a big fan of that one. Let's see, my least favorite restaurant trend at the moment.
Tom Colicchio said the swipes on the twirls on a plate, like the.
Oh yeah, he definitely hates like swooshes and
swooshes.
Swirls and stuff like that. Like, yeah, he hates that. He likes like classic old school plating, and I don't blame him. I like that too. But that might also be because I suck at like modern plating. So like it's easy to hate something that you're really bad at. Let's see, what are the things that so first of all, I hate that we have embraced really bad service, to be honest with you. Like, a lot of hip, cool, modern restaurants like have ditched caring about being particularly good at service. They somehow think that being precise at service is also the same as like being uppity. And it's not. Like, you can have a really fun, hip, cool, interesting place that has really good service and it not feel like it's formal and fine dining. So I don't really dig that sort of like standoffish attitude that I get at a lot of like kind of new school cool kid restaurants. That's not my thing. Okay. I think the other one is I don't love the current trend of using ingredients for the sake of using them. I think a lot of like younger chefs these days haven't gotten to the place that all of us old fogies have where you really analyze a dish and you go like, is that even needed on there? Or are we just doing it for the sake of doing it? And I think that sometimes a lot of the food right now that's getting pushed, a lot of acclaim, you know, sometimes it feels like it's a bit style over substance to me. And that's heavy criticism because a lot of those folks have immense talent and I can see that they're working towards something. But at the same time, I feel like I constantly have to talk to the folks who work for me and say like, I think you could do that same dish, take three components away and it'd probably be a little bit better. So
to that point, my most
hated room temperature water. I hate it. Please stop serving me room temperature water, especially in the South. Like,
yes.
If we're in like Maine, room temp is like nice. It's like 52 degrees. I can handle that. But like, if I get one more like 87 degree glass of water to go with my meal, I might lose my fucking time.
I'm totally with you on that. Okay. But to your previous point, most overused ingredient, when you talk about stuff that's used unnecessarily.
Ooh, yeah. Like, I think maybe the most overused thing, and it doesn't show up as like a main ingredient, but it's everybody's sort of obsession currently with fermenting everything. So, and I like fermented stuff, by the way.
I do. Yeah. Yeah. Like, that one hurt. That one hurt, chef.
I do too, but we don't have to make koji out of every single ingredient you've ever seen in your entire life. Like, it's just not, it doesn't, it's not necessary. Like, it's, koji's good, man, but like, not, my doorknob does not need to be turned into koji. Like, that's not going, like, to make the dish more interesting.
By the way, total hack that I've been using, and it's like cheating. I found this product called Liquid Koji.
Oh, really?
It's on a Japanese grocery website. And like, I just pour it in everything now. It's just, I don't know if it's like liquid MSG or just has that, it just has that umami-ish.
Right, right, yeah. And I mean, koji's delicious and it makes some things amazing. But I have literally walked around my restaurant and been like, wait, what did we decide to make koji out of? And they're like, we had all these hot dogs that we bought for family meal. And I'm like, okay, like, we've gone too far. Oh, so, yeah.
What is your, the restaurant that you can't wait to go back to when things open up, whether it's in Atlanta or beyond?
Well, okay, I'll give you two. So if we're talking about Atlanta, the places that I'm most looking forward to, it's not a single place. It's sort of the little tiny mom and pop ethnic places that are all over Buford Highway in Atlanta.
Yeah.
I love them so much. I actually get a tremendous amount of inspiration from them, and they're the places that have been hit really bad. Like, they don't have, they're not finding other sources of income right now. They're just literally drowning. And so I can't wait to go back to those, not only because I love the food, but because I'm very much looking forward to them reopening.
Any ones you want to shout out here?
Absolutely. So let's see, let's take, actually, Snack Box has just reopened. I love that place. It's a Laotian restaurant. Really, really fantastic. And I love it. I can't wait for Masterpiece, which is a Szechuan place, to reopen. I think that place is awesome. There's a Sinaloan restaurant that's just called Pollo Asado Sinaloa, that is some of the most delicious grilled chicken. And it sounds super simple, but man, they just nail it. It's so good. And they're actually cooking it over real wood charcoal, so you get like that real flavor, and it's just amazing. And then I had this little tiny place that I go get chow fun at, called Ming's Barbecue. And I've tried like 13 times to get food there, and it's just not happening. I need this place to reopen. It's ruining my life right now. So yeah, those are my little sort of tiny small places in Atlanta that I love. Outside of Atlanta, I love going to Maine. Like, it's one of my favorite places in the country. I love the food in Portland. I just think it's delicious. And I have been craving Eventide in Portland for weeks, months now, and I can't go because they may be open, but the governor of Maine won't let anybody outside of Maine travel to Maine, so it doesn't really matter to me.
Chef, when you went to Portland to work, was that Portland, Oregon, or Maine?
No, Oregon. So I went to Portland, Oregon to work. I'm just sort of obsessed with Maine because, well, the fat guy. I think fat guys like cold weather, you know? So it's like, I dig places that it never really gets above 67. That kind of works for me.
Yes.
How old are you, Kevin?
38.
Do you remember, you might be too young to remember, like, the first Buford Highway area, like, authentic restaurant, Honto, on Chamblee Dunwoody?
It was
the first ethnic, like, real ethnic restaurant I ever ate at. And when it opened in Atlanta, it just was like, it's like we didn't have anything like that. And you went for dim sum, and it was like Chamblee Dunwoody, not far off of
Highway.
And but anyway, it's maybe before your time. But I just like it. It kind of introduced me to, it's like, wait, food is like this. Like, I can actually go transport myself, because it used to be like Mandarin House and Sandy Springs, like all America. But no, it's just that was like the first one, and now it's honestly one of the best eating districts in the country.
Well, and so those places really inspired Gunsho, because eating their food, seeing how delicious it was, it gave me the confidence that we didn't have to follow that traditional sort of protein, starch, veg, sauce, garnish, plated, composed food thing like we do in modern American food. That you could you could just make something delicious, inherently delicious, and it didn't have to fit into our classic Western category of like appetizer entree. It could just be delicious food, and you could get a bunch of stuff and everybody could eat that way. And so really, like, even though the food at Gun Show is not particularly ethnically driven necessarily, the system, the idea, yeah, the confidence of it is very much driven by the food that I see in places like that.
Off the court, to use analogy, sports analogy, off the court, you and Brian Voltaggio seem to be really close, really good, yeah, friends. And,
yeah, we are genuinely good friends.
And he's a finalist here, and I know that you people know from watching the show that you guys are close. In Last Chance Kitchen, you wanted to challenge him mano a mano. I've been told that you were on a hunting trip, or you've been on a hunting trip with Brian Voltaggio, and I had to ask, does his giggle scare away animals, and is he a really poor hunting?
No, you know what? He's a really good hunter because he gets, just like in cooking, like when it's time to do it, he's super, uber, uber serious. So he's really like, he's just a focused dude. Like that man can like turn focus on like nobody's business. I'm the one who's much more like just shooting it live at all times. But no, Brian's laugh is, it's amazing. But like, I literally have this super clear memory of when we were on that hunting trip and we may have gotten a little too drunk. And he was just cutting up, and his laugh gets proportionately louder the drunker he gets. And as one of our other friends, Kyle Kinane, he's a comedian, he was with us on this trip, and he made the comment at one point, because Voltaggio was out by the fire pit and you could hear him laughing. We were inside the house. You could hear him laughing. And he was like, wow, Brian's really showing Tuesday night who's boss. So like, he was just, needless to say, he was having a rough Wednesday after that. But yeah, he's an awesome dude. We are very good friends. And it's interesting, man. It's just like, we connected really following season 6. We became friends on the show, but we became real friends like following the show. And I think we realized we had a lot more in common than we originally thought we did. And it's been great, man. And honestly, I wouldn't have come back and done All Stars had it not been for Brian Voltaggio. Like he and I, I think roughly at the same time. And we made a pact. We basically said, like, if you go back, I'll go back. But if you don't, I won't. And so it was sort of a package deal kind of thing.
Kevin, this was an absolute pleasure. I very much hope to be in one of your wonderful restaurants next time I'm in Atlanta, which should be Thanksgiving week if we're doing that sort of thing. It's always great to eat in Atlanta. And this was fantastic. And congratulations on a great run.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. Yeah, I was, you know, for the most part, I was pretty happy with the way that this worked out. You know, I've told everybody who's willing to listen that really the only reason I came back to Top Chef was to tell the story of kind of the journey that I've been on the last few years. It's been a struggle for a lot of it, but I haven't lost hope, and I've always tried to continue to persevere. And I found out over time that in reality, like, that story parallels just the difficult times in life and that journey. And I felt it helped me a lot when I was sick and trying to get better to listen, to hear other people tell me that they got better, that just keep going and things will be okay. And so, you know, I came back to Top Chef to do that, just to talk about that. If I could win the show, great. But honestly, like, the winning and the money has never meant anything to me. It was always, could I make a personal connection with people who maybe I would never normally in life get a chance to speak to? And choosing to come back to Top Chef was a really difficult decision for me. I've always been very happy with the way that season 6 ended for me. In my mind, that was like a single sort of journey. I didn't need to rewrite that chapter. And it was only after getting sick and fighting through that and spending a couple years sick for the most part, and coming out on the other side, that I recognized that going back to the show was actually a really important next step for me, because it did a number of things. For one, it helped me sort of finalize my journey to a certain degree. It helped me realize that, okay, I'm back. I can compete. You know, I was much rustier this time around, and I won't even pretend like I was somehow as good this time around as I was the first time. But it was still, I'm glad that I did it. But really, more importantly, the whole reason for going back was to help the next person. And I don't know who this person is. It's not a specific person. It's more just this idea that when I was struggling and I was fighting, one of the only things that really helped me was when other people would reach out. And I got so many letters and emails and phone calls from people I've never met in my life who wanted to share their story with me. And the moral of it was always, don't lose hope, keep fighting, don't give up. Remember that that your life can be bigger than this. You don't have to be defined by this illness. And that helped get me out of a lot of dark spots, like mentally. It helped me keep pushing through. And so I felt like it was my responsibility now to share that. And Top Chef is the biggest platform I've ever been given in my life. And it's likely the biggest I'll ever be given. And so going back on the show, I never cared about winning the money, and I never cared about winning Top Chef, which I know is just kind of a silly thing to say, but it doesn't mean very much to me, and it never really has. And it certainly doesn't mean that much to me anymore, because life is more complex than that. I know that now at this point, that that winning or success, as it were, for me at this point in this stage of my career, is providing opportunity for other people. It's using my platform to speak on the behalf of people who don't have that chance. And it's sharing this story that is important to me, which is that that life constantly throws us not only curveballs, sometimes it just pushes us down in the ditch, and climbing back out of it can feel impossible some days, but that we all have this capacity for hope inside of us, and never letting that extinguish is really important. And so I'm actually really happy with my performance on this season, because I stayed long enough to share that full story. And that was always my goal.
Are we going to be seeing you this week?
I don't know if I'm allowed to tell you that.
Well, I don't think I saw you in the show preview. So,
okay. Well, then I'll take a note. Surprise. Yeah. I'll let it be a surprise for you. Let's just say that, you know, it's expensive to send people home from Italy until everybody goes home. So I'm still hanging around in some capacity or another. I mean, at the end of the day, even when I'm not in the episode, I'm really always there. You just don't see me. I'm that guy like behind the curtain, like constantly like needling people. So I like to joke that I'm just off camera and that the frame has just cut out. So,
well, really, Kevin, go ahead.
Yeah, no, thanks for sharing your story. And it is a great story. And thank you for coming on.
Yeah, man, absolutely. I appreciate you guys giving me a chance to chat about it. Obviously, it's one of those that it's a show that people love. And sometimes as a participant, you forget that because it's hard, you know, and it's grueling. But it is important to a lot of folks, and people get a lot of enjoyment out of it. And I think, honestly, this time around, as strange as it might sound, like it was a nice thing to have for a lot of people, because it was every Thursday, at least, you could count on sort of being able to dive into this journey that wasn't just 100% centered around the fact that we're all at home trying to make do with what's coming next.
I think the most important thing is that you made Kevin look smart for getting you number one overall. You provided some value, man, on that pick.
That, well, hey, honestly, you picking Gregory was smart. If I'd been a betting man, I probably would have bet on Gregory myself. So he's a beast. He's really, really good. And it was a real pleasure to get a chance to cook alongside him. And frankly, everybody there. There are no slouches this season, for sure.
Well, Chef, thank you so much for joining us. And we really hope to see you in person soon at one of your restaurants. At the very least, thanks so much for sharing your story. In times like these, it's really important message. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. Thanks for letting me ramble on.